Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Ken.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're less than 2 weeks away from Election Day, and the two Wisconsin candidates for U.S. Senate, incumbent Ron Johnson and challenger Russ Feingold, are ramping up their efforts to make their case for your vote. But the race for Senate has gotten a little more heated recently. Both candidates have traded barbs, with Feingold being critical of Johnson's time in the Senate, and with Johnson calling Feingold a phony.
Joining us now to talk about the contentious Senate race is Mark Sommerhauser. He's a political reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal and has been following the Feingold-Johnson matchup. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, before we get into these personal attacks by these two candidates, let's talk about what the polling is telling us. Where do these two candidates stand in the polls this week?
Yeah, so, you know, throughout this race, going back to last year, polls of the race consistently have shown the challenger and former Senator Russ Feingold, the Democrat, leading in the race. However, some recent polls have suggested that the race is getting tighter. The most recent Marquette Law School poll showed the race being within the margin of error, with Feingold up by just two percentage points. So there are some indications that while Feingold is perhaps still considered the favorite, the race has become more competitive.
So as this race tightens, why is it getting so personal? We've heard some pretty bitter remarks on both sides by both candidates.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think part of it, no doubt, is just can be attributed to things getting a little more intense here as we get closer to Election Day. And certainly part of it seems to have stemmed from some of the comments that were made by Senator Johnson here, beginning with his interview with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel editorial board last week, and spilling over into last weekend when he continued to make these comments on the campaign trail about Russ Feingold and his words being a phony.
Yeah, and talking a little bit about that phony quote, you know, Feingold said, in contrast, he's not going there. What is the there he's referring to? Where are the boundaries in these political attacks?
Yeah, I think, you know, he seemed to be suggesting that he did not want the race to sort of descend into personal attacks or name-calling or anything like that. However, you know, when he was pressed a little more to kind of respond to Johnson, he later on in the press conference sort of alluded to, you know, the notion that perhaps this is a sign that Senator Johnson is desperate in his words and that he is feeling, you know, increasingly worried about his reelection prospects.
One of the issues they've been sparring over is whether Senator Johnson's done enough to deal with the heroin and the opioid painkiller epidemic. Do you think this is going to stay a central issue in this race, or are there other issues that will surface as we get closer to Election Day?
Well, that's tough to say. I mean, certainly for anyone who you know, has dealt with this issue or has family members dealing with this issue, it's a very personal one. You know, I think the, as you said, sparring over that issue sort of began sometime last month when the Feingold campaign really sought to make an issue of Johnson, you know, in their words, not having done enough to sort of combat the crisis of abuse of both heroin and opioid drugs. The Johnson campaign really pushed back hard on that and said, listen, you know, this is something that is very personal to Senator Johnson, as he had a nephew who died of a heroin overdose, and you know, they pointed to some legislation that Senator Johnson has offered that they said would reduce some of the incentives for doctors to sort of excessively prescribe some of these opiate drugs. So they really pushed back on the notion that somehow Johnson has not been engaged on that issue, and that seems to set the ground, the foundation for a lot of the sort of back and forth that we've seen here over the last few days.
We're talking with Mark Sommerhauser. He's political reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Talking now, turning to the super PACs, we've seen an infusion of cash into these super PACs in this race. Can you talk a little bit about the money going into the PACs?
Yeah, that's right. You know, something that I reported on in the State Journal today was stemming from some reports that were just recently made public that were filed with the Federal Election Commission, which showed that in particular, a billionaire businesswoman from Boyd area, Diane Hendricks, who has been a very generous donor to Republican candidates and causes in the past, gave more than $1.3 million to a super PAC that has been airing ads, negative ads against Feingold. You know, there are independent groups on both sides in this race. In terms of super PACs specifically, we have seen more of that on the Republican side, starting with the group that Ms. Hendricks contributed to, a super PAC called Reform America Fund, as well as some other super PACs that have sprung up that primarily are airing negative ads against Russ Feingold.
Yeah, and how do you see the presidential race factoring into the Senate race? Ron Johnson, of course, still supporting Trump. How is the presidential race in this?
That's right. I mean, that's just one of the huge questions in this Senate race, as well as really almost every other competitive Senate race in the country. It does vary somewhat from one state to another. We've seen states where Republican incumbent senators are pulling well ahead of Donald Trump. That so far here in Wisconsin has not been the case for Ron Johnson. He has, in most polls, been either behind Trump or running fairly even with him. There are some signs in some of the most recent polling that he may be starting to finally nudge ahead of Trump, but I think that's really the question everyone's asking, is how that presidential race is going to affect Ron Johnson. And as you noted, so far he has, while making clear that he disagrees with some of Trump's remarks, has maintained his support for Trump.
Well, let's stop and look back at how we got to this point. What was the political climate like when Feingold lost his seat to Johnson?
Yeah, I mean, that was in 2010, and that was really, I think, a pretty unique political climate, in the sense that that was 2 years after President Obama had been elected. And 2009, 2010, there were Democratic majorities in the House and Senate. We saw a number of significant pieces of legislation pass in that period of time, including the Federal Stimulus Act and the Affordable Care Act, the Obamacare Act. And so there was a Tea Party movement that really sprung up in opposition to a lot of that legislation that really provided the foundation for Ron Johnson to launch his political career.
And there's also been criticism, Feingold's camp criticizing Johnson's conduct of his plastics manufacturing company, whether he took a payout from that company. What's been the fallout from that?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, this was an issue that came to light a number of years ago. It's been really resurfaced during the campaign now. The issue was what Johnson's campaign has referred to as a deferred compensation package that he took from the plastics manufacturing company that he helped to found, a $10 million payout. Johnson and his campaign have maintained that this was something that was arranged for in advance, and this was something that had been planned all along, that he had not taken a salary for a number of years from the company, and that this payout was simply a deferred compensation package to account for that. Democrats have really attacked the payout as saying that it was essentially a violation of campaign finance laws, because Johnson did invest a lot of his own money, I believe about $9 million of his own money, in his Senate campaign in 2010. And so their argument was essentially that by accepting this payout from a company, that it was violating campaign finance restrictions on corporate money flowing into political campaigns.
And we're talking with Mark Sommerhauser, who is a political reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. Mark, curious about your coverage of this and what you have seen in this Senate race. What has stood out to you about this contest? What's been interesting to you as a reporter?
Certainly the developments the last few days have been interesting. I think there's been a sense all along, for not just myself, but the other folks who've paid close attention to this race, that perhaps these candidates don't really like one another. And that really seems to have been something that maybe has simmered beneath the surface for a while, that has sort of bubbled over, if you will, here in the last few days. They're certainly political opposites in terms of their political ideologies. And they're also opposites in terms of their resumes and their backgrounds. Feingold, of course, somebody who has served in elected office for several decades. And Ron Johnson, somebody who really was, a longtime manufacturer who did not begin his political career until 2010. So they are different in a lot of ways. And whether that's contributing to some of the enmity between them, I don't know. But it has been interesting to watch, certainly the last few days, that this race really has gotten a little more personal.
And as we tick down the days to Election Day, what will both candidates be campaigning on over these final days? Where will they put their energy?
Well, the Feingold campaign is, just put out a release, I believe, today, in which they said they'll be focusing on jobs and the economy, and as well as taking a look at the issue of outsourcing jobs. Accusing the Johnson campaign of having not done enough to prevent jobs from being outsourced. That's been an issue all along for the Feingold campaign, as has been issues such as raising the minimum wage and helping people deal with the cost of student debt. Ron Johnson, I think we can certainly expect him to continue to talk about his record, some of the legislation he's offered and passed in the U.S. Senate, as well as some of the work that he's done on national security issues. He's chairman of the U.S. Senate Homeland Security Committee, and so national security and anti-terrorism type efforts have been a big focal point for him, and that's something he's really sought to make a central issue in this campaign.
Well, thanks so much, Mark.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Mark Sommerhauser is a political reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal. He joined us to talk about the ongoing Wisconsin Senate race between Ron Johnson and Russ Feingold.
For years, scientists have reasoned music is popular, it's ancient, and continually ranked as one of the most supreme pleasures of life. Given all that, they wondered, is there a region of the brain that responds specifically to music?
There's a region of the brain that deals specifically with visual cues, like faces. For a long time, scientists couldn't find a similar area of the brain that responded to music. Until now, a research team at MIT has been given a peek into what's being called the brain's music room. Using functional MRIs, they've identified the specific neural pathways that react almost exclusively to music.
Here to talk about the findings are two members of that team from MIT. Nancy Kanwisher is a professor at MIT and an investigator at the McGovern Institute for Brain Research. Her lab uses functional MRIs to investigate the functional architecture of the human brain. Nancy, great to have you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And also with us today, we've got Sam Norman Hagner, a postdoctoral researcher at MIT, whose work focuses on understanding the human auditory cortex. Sam, welcome.
Thanks.
And so, Nancy, going into this research, what exactly were you looking for?
Well, as background, I've been looking for the last 20 years or so at the overall organization of the human brain. So we think that's a really exciting question because it's basically a way to ask, who are we? What are our brains made up of? What are the basic components of the human mind? And that's been a very exciting research program, and we've discovered a lot of specialized regions of the brain that respond very selectively to when you do very specific kinds of things, like face recognition, or reading a word, or thinking about what another person is thinking, or understanding a sentence. Each of those activates a very specific part of the brain. And so we wanted to know for a long time whether music might be another mental function that has its own special purpose brain machinery. So that was a tough question to answer until Sam came along. So maybe he can tell you what he's done.
Right. And Sam, why did music seem like such a likely candidate for dedicated brain architecture, so to speak?
Well, one of the nice things about the approach that we use to reveal this putatively music-selective region is that the analysis that we used to find it basically didn't know anything about what it should find, didn't know whether it should find something that was selected for music or speech or, whatever else. And so as a result, when we ran this analysis and it basically revealed this neural population that responded selectively to music, we found that sort of particularly striking because basically the analysis didn't know anything about what it should find a priori.
So you said this is a kind of a neutral way. This is computational. How did this work? How did you get to this answer, Nancy?
The simple way of thinking of it is you start with a large amount of data. So we have 10,000 individual three-dimensional pixels or voxels across 10 subjects' brains in their broader auditory cortex, and we know the magnitude of the response of each of those pixels to each of 165 different sounds. So that's 18 million numbers. And then what we do is we ask the math to simplify this and give us a simple description of the data, and it basically finds six simple components that can account for most of the data. And that didn't have to be. That was a cool result in itself, that we could understand and characterize the response of the brain to this wide array of different kinds of sounds with six simple patterns. And it just emerged when we looked at those six patterns that one of them reflected selectivity for music. And that's just remarkable because the space of possible things we could find is just enormous. And the fact that one of them very neatly mapped on, just when we looked at it, you could just see, oh, that's music selectivity, a high response to all of these wildly different kinds of music sounds, and a low response to everything else. So it just popped right out of the raw data.
And I want to give a listen to some of the things that your subjects were listening to, because you have a whole array of, I guess, auditory cues, different sounds, and music. Let's listen to the sounds first.
It's supposed to either rain or snow.
Hannah is good at compromising.
Okay, so you've got the stuff of everyday life there. You've got toilets flushing. You've got people talking. You've got people brushing your teeth. The brains of your subjects heard all that. And they also heard some music. They heard stuff like this. So they heard all that, tons of different styles of music there, all those different sounds mixed in. How did the brain tell them apart?
Well, so, I mean, like, one of the interesting aspects of the finding is that this music selective population that we discovered responded to lots of different types of music. And one of the interesting facts about music in general is that music is a remarkably heterogeneous category. There are lots of different types of things that people typically call music, and it's very different from the types of categories that we know exist for other types of things. So, for example, speech is a much more homogeneous category. You know, the different types of speech sounds that people encounter are in some sense much more similar than the different types of music that we encounter. And so the fact that you find a brain region that responds in some sense strongly to all of these different types of music is sort of one of the interesting results of the experiment.
To back up a moment, music is fascinating because every human culture that's been studied has it, and no animal that's been studied has anything approaching human music. And so it's both uniquely and universally human, and yet at the same time, nobody even knows why we have it. So evolutionary theorists have been fighting for a long time trying to understand why we have music, and nobody has a really clear story about why we have it. And so one story was that music just kind of piggybacks on other brain mechanisms, for example, mechanisms for understanding speech or processing language or God knows what else, right? And what our result shows is understanding music or perceiving music isn't just a byproduct of other mechanisms. It has its own special purpose mechanism. So it's its own thing. It's not a byproduct. And I think that's a fascinating result of this research.
We're talking right now with Nancy Kanwisher and Sam Norman Hagner, part of the team that use functional MRIs to locate specific neural pathways in the brain that respond exclusively to music. And as you were saying, Nancy, from an evolutionary perspective, it doesn't seem like music would be as important to survival as, say, speech. So what do we know about why music may have this privileged role in the brain, and how is that going to change the way that we think about music?
Well, the why questions are very hard. I think the answer could easily have been otherwise, and it's an empirical result that, wow, apparently we do have this special purpose machinery. The question of why different mental functions get specialized machinery in the brain is a really big, important one, but we just don't know the answer. And I want to mention that, like, not everything that has special machinery in the brain is the product of evolution and natural selection. So, for example, there's a part of the brain that responds very selectively and strongly to visually presented words. And that can't be a result of natural selection because people haven't been reading long enough for evolution to have crafted it. So we shouldn't assume that just because there are special neural mechanisms for music that they've evolved. It may be that they result from extensive experience with music. And this is something we can't tell yet from our current experiments. But Sam has lots of ideas of what to do next to find out.
Right, and I'd love to hear that, Sam. Where would you like to see this research go from here?
So there are a lot of sort of open questions about what this specific music population does. So, for example, you asked the question of, you know, how does your brain differentiate between all the different types of music that you typically listen to? And that's basically a question that we don't really know the answer to. We know that there's, you know, this population that responds strongly to a lot of different types of music, but we don't know, for example, whether there are subpopulations within this area that, say, respond to musical rhythms or to musical pitches or to musical harmonies. Basically, we don't know how all of the different aspects of musical structure that you're sensitive to and care about are mapped in this population and other populations of the brain.
Does this tell you as a researcher, though, just for the layperson, that, yeah, there's a reason why we respond so powerfully to music?
That's a very hard question, I think, to answer. I mean, it suggests that music is a sufficiently sort of important category to warrant, you know, a relatively large piece of tissue to process it. But exactly how that maps onto, you know, our appreciation of music and the emotional impact that music has on us is a sort of a harder question to answer, I think.
All right, we'll leave it there. Nancy and Sam, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
That was Nancy Kanwisher and Sam Norman Hagner. They're part of the team that used functional MRIs to locate specific neural pathways in the brain that respond to music.
On November 8th, 9 states, including California, Arizona, Florida, and Massachusetts, will have marijuana legalization referendums on the ballot. Nationwide, 57% of U.S. adults believe the use of marijuana should be made legal, while 37% say it should be illegal.
Here in Wisconsin, we see a similar trend. A recent Marquette Law School poll reveals that 59% of registered Wisconsin voters agreed that marijuana should be fully legalized and regulated like alcohol.
Joining us now is John Hudak. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Marijuana, A Short History. Welcome back to Central Time, John.
Thanks for having me back.
So we've got these polling numbers here, the Gallup poll that came out less than a week ago, showing that there is stronger support for the legalization of marijuana, and even compared with the presidential candidates. Can you talk us through this shift in public opinion?
Sure. The shift in public opinion has really come about because of two central reasons. The first is, I think a lot of people are looking out across the country at the 4 states and District of Columbia that have legalized adult-use marijuana, and the 25 states and the District of Columbia that have legalized medical marijuana, and they've said, you know what, the sky isn't falling in these states. The doomsday predictions of some opponents of reform have not really fully come to fruition. And because of that, people are growing a bit more comfortable with this. Add to that, there are a lot of Americans who have experience with marijuana, not heavy users, but many Americans have experimented with it or used it on occasion, and some use it regularly, and they know what their own experience with that drug has been like. And that helps shift opinions on this issue. But what adds to that is this change in demographics in the U.S. The people who oppose legalization the most in the U.S. are people aged 65 and over. The people who support marijuana reform the most are millennials. And so you have people turning 18 who have levels of support for reform around 80% or higher. And the people who are, frankly, dying off are people who have support around 35 to 38%. And so that generational replacement is leading to pretty rapid change as well.
Why do you see such a difference between the generations toward their attitude toward marijuana?
Well, a lot of people, a lot of older Americans grew up during the height of the drug war. And while some of the people in that age demographic are children of the 60s who experienced this in unprecedented ways during their youth, there were still a lot of people who were subject to government propaganda about the ill effects of marijuana. And as my book talks quite a bit about, that propaganda at times was so extreme it would suggest that marijuana use led to murder and rape and insanity and a whole variety of psychoses. And those types of culturation really stays with people over time, and it stayed with this group as well.
And heading into the elections, you know, voters have been trying to pick apart the presidential candidates and where they stand on both medical marijuana and recreational use. We found a clip, of course, of Hillary Clinton speaking during primary season at a town hall in February about medical marijuana legalization. Let's take a listen.
I want to move it from a Schedule 1 drug to a Schedule 2 so that we can begin to do more research. The NIH and a lot of universities can begin to try to find out, because I want you to know what we know from science. But I also want you to be able to use it while we're doing the research. And so many states, as you know, have moved to provide legal protection for the use of medical marijuana. I support that. I think that the states are the laboratories of our democracy. We should be learning about what works, what doesn't work. Different states have actually listed the kinds of illnesses and conditions that it can be used for. Are they right? We don't know. That's why we got to do the research.
So from hearing that clip, do we know today where she stands, as well as Donald Trump stands, on this issue?
I think we know pretty well what Hillary Clinton thinks about this, and while that was a long answer, she's effectively saying we need to do more research. And while I think some in the medical marijuana reform community would argue that they have all of the information that they need, they see the therapeutic effects of cannabis every day, the medical community is not there yet. The scientific community does not have that sufficient evidence yet. But she also argues, and Donald Trump does the same on medical marijuana, to let the states do as they want, to take a hands-off approach. It's really the Obama doctrine of marijuana, and that is to let states experiment, and as long as there are not, you know, tragic harms going on, let them do this while we figure out the best answers that we can.
And for scientists who are trying to do medical experiments using marijuana, they can only get this for their research from one place, I understand, from a farm at the University of Mississippi. Why is it so difficult for researchers to run experiments on marijuana to evaluate its medicinal claims?
Well, that's right. The single source of marijuana for research use comes from a farm at Ole Miss. And while the government has since lifted that monopoly, that DEA-mandated monopoly, the effects of that lifting of the monopoly have not taken effect yet. We don't have other growers around the country producing research-grade cannabis, and so still the effective policy is the single source. It's difficult for researchers to do this because, as Secretary Clinton mentioned in the clip that you played, marijuana is a Schedule 1 drug. That means under federal law, it is illegal in all circumstances. It has no medical value. It can't be used safely for medical use. And that means that the government puts the tightest restrictions on its use, even in research settings. And so the licensure requirements necessary for researchers who want to conduct these studies, the security requirements for the labs are tremendous and they're costly. They take years to get approval. And that creates real disincentives. It creates a real chilling effect for researchers who are considering going into this area.
We're talking with John Hudak. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Marijuana, A Short History. John, there has been a precedent of petitions over decades, I understand, to reschedule marijuana, to make it not a Schedule 1 substance. How has this petition process gone?
So the Controlled Substances Act, which is the most significant drug control law in the United States, spells out a procedure for how a drug can get rescheduled, that is, moved from one categorization to a different categorization. And there have been four petitions going through this process to try to move marijuana out of Schedule 1 and into some other schedule. And that petition is a complicated, that petition process is a complicated one. It requires an analysis from the Drug Enforcement Agency, from the Food and Drug Administration, from the Attorney General, and that process takes years typically. Even if it shouldn't take years, it does. And even if through all of the analyses that are done on law enforcement aspects of it, on addiction and abuse potential, on medical value, even if there is a determination that it should be moved, then a whole regulatory process starts, which can also be time-consuming. For the four petitions on marijuana, however, everyone has been rejected. That is, the government has determined that there is no reason to move it out of Schedule 1, and the most recent ruling on that came this August.
Why do you think that is? What is holding this back? Where is this red tape coming from?
The government will tell you that the what is holding it back is the failure to demonstrate medical value. Now, this is a controversial claim. Looking just at American scholarship on this point, there is limited evidence by medical community standards of its use. But if you look abroad, researchers in a variety of countries have been doing work in this area for decades, and there is significant evidence broadly that there is medical value. I think the challenge around this policy is less the letter of the law and more the policy realities. And I've written about this on our Brookings FixGov blog as well as in my book that, you know, the letter of the law may say if this has not cleared the hurdle for medical value, then you need to keep it in Schedule 1. But Schedule 1 makes it harder to do research on this drug. Well, there's a policy reality in this country, and that is that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of Americans are using marijuana for medical use every day. States are allowing them to do it, and the federal government is taking a hands-off approach that effectively lets Americans do this. Well, that policy reality demands better answers for those patients, better understandings of what the medical value is, what dosing should be, what conditions it works best for, what interactions there might be or side effects there might be, what the best vehicle of delivery, whether you should smoke it or vape it or eat it or use it in a cream or a variety of other ways you can consume it. The answers need to be had because so many people are using this for medical value. And so while the government has its reason for keeping it in Schedule 1, I think a lot of people look at this and are left dissatisfied and really have a difficulty understanding why that policy continues.
We're talking with John Hudak. He's senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the book Marijuana, A Short History.
And we want to hear from you. Was your DARE program effective? Do you support the legalization of marijuana? Are you a recreational drug user, or have you tried it for medicinal purposes? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're taking your calls now. How do you feel about the trend toward legalization and decriminalization of marijuana? That's our topic this half hour. And we're wondering if you or one of your family members have ever used medicinal marijuana. You can let us know what conversations you may have had with your children about marijuana use. You can call us now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Right now, we're picking up the conversation with John Hudak, who's the senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and author of the new book, Marijuana, A Short History. John, you say that there needs to be discussion around the recreational value of marijuana, that there are people who do like to get high, and this has to be something that is talked about. It's worth talking about, you say. Can you talk a little bit about this point of view?
Absolutely. In a lot of the states that have had marijuana legalization referendum for adult use, for recreational use, a lot of times the conversation is around the system being regulated better, displacing the black market, the tax benefits that can be had, and a variety of other arguments. Liberty, for instance, is a big one. And those are all important, legitimate, and serious arguments to be had on the pro-reform side. But what's interesting to me is one of the topics that people tend to shy away from, and it's true in the reform community and it's true elsewhere, is the idea that, as I write in my book, some people just like to get high. In the same way, in whether it's high to sort of a movie-style rendition of what we think of that, or whether it's someone who uses marijuana in whatever form to relax or to take an edge off, or whatever it is, people enjoy using the product. Some people enjoy using the product, and that should not necessarily be seen as a harm. Some people like to have a glass of wine. Some people like to have a fancy dinner. Some people like to go out and play basketball. There's benefit to be had based on what your likes and dislikes are. And I think the culture that we've had in this country and the views around marijuana that have held for nearly a century, or frankly a century or more, is that this is inherently something that people should dislike, and that its use should only exist under very controlled experiences. While the control aspect is probably right, I think it's a disservice to act as if this is not a recreational drug for a lot of people. And frankly, a lot of people go to the polls and vote yes because they like it. And I think it speaks to what prohibition has done in terms of people being honest about their views on this product.
Well, let's hear from callers. We have Kevin from Crandon. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
What do you have to say?
Yeah, I'm fully for legalization, either recreationally, medicinally, either one. I believe, five states have it on the ballot for recreational and four for medicinal, which has already been approved in 26 states. So just, you know, let's say all nine of these pass, that would make it 35 states out of 50. And here we are in Wisconsin, which any thoughtful person living here in Wisconsin can tell that Wisconsin has a very serious drinking problem. And yet people are still being made into full-blown criminals for possession of small amounts of marijuana. I don't believe that's right. And I would like to, I don't know if your guest knows a book I read recently called Weed the People. Came out, I think, last year. But anyway, the author, it was all about the legalization in Colorado and Washington.
And so what about the small amounts of marijuana, John, as Kevin talked about? Is the legal system going too far in regulating with, busting people for small amounts?
That is one of the central arguments in the discussion around marijuana reform, is that the war on drugs in this context has not worked, and that the effect of it has been that a significant number of people have faced law enforcement repercussions because of small amounts of marijuana. Now, I think there are some people who get carried away in this conversation and would make you think that anyone who's ever been charged with a marijuana crime in history has only been caught with a joint. That, of course, is not the case. We have traffickers and we have mass producers that are clearly violating what anyone would want to be the law. But there are significant numbers of people who are caught for small amounts. And even if you don't do jail time for that, you still get a criminal record out of it. And I think a lot of people think law enforcement resources are put to better use by not dealing with that situation, and that people's lives should not be upended because they are caught with small amounts of marijuana. It's something that the reform community argues quite rigorously as a need for reform, and it's something that I think connects with a lot of voters and a lot of Americans who, again, have used the drug illegally at certain times in their lives and would think back to whether it's one day in college that they did it or a period of their life where they used it, where they would hope or they would think, well, thank God a policeman didn't catch me, and my life might have gone in a different direction. For a lot of people, and particularly people of color, this is the type of law enforcement incident that can really have long-term effects for them.
Let's take another caller, Shane from Beloit. Hi, Shane.
Hi there. So I just want to say I am a regular recreational cannabis user. It's something that your guest had mentioned, like, used to wind down. I sort of self-medicated, in a sense, for anxiety and insomnia with it for a number of years. It's really helped me calm myself down and just sort of, it's just sort of a way to level the playing field of myself mentally and just be ready for the day. And so I find it very...
Oh, I think we're losing you there, Shane. You know, do you see, John, a fine line between people using it for recreational and people going too far? And where is that line? Where do you cross the line?
Well, that's a great point. And I think generally a lot of people are able to use substances in responsible ways, like alcohol, like caffeine, like marijuana. Most people who use marijuana do not abuse marijuana. We know that the addiction and dependence rate is actually quite low. It's lower than it is for alcohol. And so are there people who abuse marijuana? Are there people who have clinical dependency disorders? Absolutely. And those are people who need help. Because some people will become addicted to this drug is clearly not a basis for outlawing it. If that were the case, nicotine would be illegal, caffeine would be illegal, and alcohol would be illegal as well. I think there are some people, and I've heard this in the reform community, that, well, marijuana is not addicting. It can't cause dependency. That's not entirely true. But those dependency rates are much lower than have been reported previously or have been used in, again, propaganda campaigns.
So what are the cultural shifts you're seeing in the attitudes? Where do you see marijuana in 10 or 20 years? Where, you know, what will prevail among attitudes toward marijuana?
You know, people on both sides of this issue, reformers and people who are opponents, will look out at this landscape and they will tell you the same thing, and that is public opinion is moving in a clear direction, and if that public opinion has an impact on policymakers, we will see large-scale federal reform down the road. Now, attaching a time clock to that is always a risky prediction, but I think if you look 10 years into the future, you're going to see a very different landscape around this policy. You're going to see the federal government much more engaged. You're going to see an American public that is broadly supportive of it, even more broadly than the statistics, the very accurate statistics that you mentioned at the startup of this segment of 57 to 60% of Americans favoring recreational marijuana, 80% of Americans or more favoring medical marijuana. We're moving in that direction because of public opinion trends, and that is eventually going to put pressure on members of Congress, and as more millennials become members of Congress and as attitudes within Congress shift.
I'm going to have to stop you there, John. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And that was John Hudak, a senior fellow at Brookings Institution and the author of the new book, Marijuana, A Short History.
Well, we are definitely in the midst of fall cooking season, and I just came back from a weekend in Door County, finally got around to picking apples at the orchard, which was really fun. So fun, in fact, that we have enormous quantities of apples. And now that I look at them, I kind of want to cry because I don't know what to do with that many apples. Kate, do you have any ideas about what I'm supposed to do with all these apples?
Use them very soon. But, you know, apple pie is just my go-to favorite with fresh apples. Love apple pie.
How many apples go in one pie?
Well, that varies across recipes. But, you know, apple pie is great. And, you know, there are a lot of recipes I know out there from listeners who have always, you know, loved to share their recipes. But I think you're going to have to really start getting creative.
Right. I think I need to ask for help. Do you have ideas about your favorite recipes for apple pie, maybe savory applications for apples, because I think I could go nuts making apple pie and apple strudel and apple cake, and I'll do that, but I'm still going to have bushels of apples left over.
Can't you, like, sneak apples into something, you know?
Sneaky just, chef style.
Yeah.
I don't know. Puree them and put them in.
Yeah.
I don't know what.
Making something up. apple ingredient.
Right. Well, let us know your favorite apple recipe. You can do that on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.